Sometimes you just want to cut through all the noise and really get to the heart of a topic, right? You want to understand it deeply without getting bogged down in all the endless details.
Absolutely, we're all about that.
That's exactly what we're aiming for today. We're diving deep into a really foundational piece of understanding. We're looking at how the Old Testament defines God and how he made things right with his people, what theologians call atonement.
A big topic for sure.
It is. And for this deep dive, we're drawing on the work of Dr. Robert A. Peterson.
Great choice. He always gets right to the core of things.
Totally. Specifically, we're looking at his insights from Church and Last Things, Session 5, People of God in the Old Testament, Their God, Atonement.
That's a mouthful, but it lays a great foundation for understanding how the Old Testament shapes the identity of God's people.
Exactly. We want to see how that unique connection with God, and specifically his name, his core characteristics, and this idea of atonement all fit together.
It's all connected, that's for sure.
So our goal today is to extract the essential understanding of who God's people were way back then.
Right. Who were these people?
Exactly. We want to see how God revealed himself and how he provided a way for their sins to be addressed.
Let's get into it.
Okay, let's jump in. Let's start with the people of God and their God.
The crucial starting point is this. The identity of God's Old Testament people is absolutely inseparable from their relationship with him. It's like you can't understand one without the other.
Right. It's foundational to everything else.
Completely foundational.
And where does this relationship even begin to take shape in our understanding?
Well, I would say
it starts with something fundamental of God's name. And we see this revealed in a powerful encounter with Moses in Exodus 3.
Oh, yeah, that's a key moment for sure.
Verses 14 and 15.
Right. When Moses asks what he should tell the Israelites about, who sent him, you know, who are you, basically.
Exactly.
God's answer is so profound. I am who I am.
Wow.
It gives me chills every time I read it.
Right. And then he tells Moses to say, the Lord, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever.
That's heavy stuff.
I am who I am. You know, it sounds so simple.
It does.
But it's so packed with meaning.
Like Christopher Morgan explains, and Peterson highlights this too, there's a lot to unpack in those few words.
So much depth. So what does Morgan see there?
Well, one thing he does is connect this I am to God's promise in Exodus 3.12, I will be with you.
A promise.
It really emphasizes God's constant covenant faithfulness. You know, he's not some distant, uninvolved being.
Right.
He's actively present with his people. He's committed to them.
Right. It's not just about him existing, but about his promise to be there, a promise of unwavering commitment.
That's it, exactly. And then Morgan also points out that this I am, you know, rooted in the verb to be, also reveals God's complete sovereign freedom.
So there are layers to this.
Layers and layers.
And that's a powerful statement about who he is.
It underscores that God doesn't depend on the Israelites in any way.
Right. He's not lacking anything.
Instead, their very existence, their well-being, is entirely dependent on his gracious choice and sovereign will.
Ah, so it really flips the script.
Right. He is the ultimate source. He needs nothing from them.
Okay, that's profound. And then, as Peterson points out, God goes on to replace I am with Yahweh.
Often translated as the Lord, yeah.
Yeah, the Lord. And he specifically identifies himself as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Why is that connection so vital for understanding who his people were?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, it shows the unbroken line of the covenant. It's not a new deity suddenly appearing. It's the same God who made promises to their ancestors.
Ah, so it's about continuity.
Yes. Reaffirming his commitment across generations.
It's the God they knew.
Yes, and the God who keeps his word. That's really important.
So if we were to boil it all down, what are the key takeaways for understanding who God's Old Testament people were based on his name?
Ultimately, God defines his people through his own character and actions,
which are revealed in his name.
Exactly. He is faithful to his promises, utterly sovereign in his power, gracious in his dealings with them, and bound to them through covenant. Their identity as his people flows directly from who he is and how he has revealed himself.
Wow, that's a beautiful summation.
Okay.
So we have a sense of the who in terms of their God's name and initial self-revelation.
Right. Now we know who we're talking about.
So now let's dig a little deeper into the very nature of God, his attribute.
Okay, getting into the nitty-gritty here.
Peterson, drawing on theological tradition, distinguishes between incommunicable and communicable attributes. Can you make sense of this distinction for us?
Yeah, think of it this way. Incommunicable attributes are those qualities that are absolutely unique to God.
Like things that humans just don't share.
Exactly. And communicable attributes, on the other hand, are those that God shares with humanity.
But in a limited way, right?
Right, in a limited way, because we're created in his image.
And yeah, that makes sense. Okay, let's start with those incommunicable attributes, the ones that are God's alone. Peterson provides quite a list, doesn't he?
He does. He goes all out.
What are some of the big ones?
So we have aseity, which is his self-existence.
Okay.
Then there's unity, the fact that he is one. And then there's spirituality, meaning he's a being without a physical body. Then we have infinity, though, as Peterson wisely notes, fully grasping this with our human minds is a challenge.
Right. It's hard to wrap our heads around.
Yeah, infinity is a tough one. Then there's omnipresence, his being everywhere, omnipotence, his all-powerful nature, omniscience, his all-knowing nature, eternity, his timeless existence, immutability, his unchanging nature, and his greatness, his surpassing excellence.
Wow, that's a powerful list.
It is.
And you can immediately see how these qualities set God apart.
Oh, yeah, there's nothing else like him.
Peterson even mentions that these attributes naturally lead his people to awe and a desire to serve him.
That's a pretty natural response, isn't it?
Totally. When you consider the sheer scope of all that.
Absolutely. When you begin to contemplate the magnitude of these attributes, it inevitably inspires reverence. You know, like, who wouldn't want to align their life with such a God?
It's humbling.
So humbling. And what's particularly insightful is how Peterson then explains how these seemingly otherly attributes actually minister to his people in very real ways.
Oh, that's interesting. Give us some tangible examples. How do these attributes, like his self-existence or his being infinite, actually impact their daily lives or their understanding of God?
Well, consider his aseity, unity, and spirituality.
Right.
Peterson points out that these act as a powerful inherent warning against idolatry. You know, if God has no source, is uniquely one, and is spirit, then creating physical idols is not only pointless,
right?
It's a direct contradiction of his very being.
So it goes against his nature.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And we see this emphasized in Deuteronomy 4 and Jeremiah 2.
Those are good examples.
Yeah.
So it really grounds the prohibition against idols in God's very nature.
It does.
Okay, what about something like infinity? How does that touch their lives?
Well, Peterson suggests that from his limitless resources, God continuously cares for and renews his people. You know, Isaiah 40 speaks so beautifully about God's inexhaustible strength.
I love that passage.
And his ability to sustain even those who are weary. It's a source of endless provision and hope for renewal.
It's comforting.
Very comforting.
Okay, what about omnipresence, the idea that he is everywhere at the same time? How would that resonate with them?
This offers constant presence and guidance. Think of Psalm 139, where David marvels that there is nowhere he can go to escape God's presence.
Oh, yeah, that's a powerful image.
Isn't it? It provides a sense of security and constant companionship, knowing God is always there.
So it's not just about knowing where he is, but knowing he is with them.
Exactly.
Okay, what about his power, his omnipotence? How did that shape their understanding?
That was their ultimate assurance of deliverance. Remember the Exodus, as recorded in Exodus 14 and Deuteronomy 4?
Oh, yeah. The big escape from Egypt.
God's unmatched power was directly involved in rescuing them from slavery in Egypt. It showed them a God who could act decisively on their behalf.
And do amazing things.
Amazing things, yeah.
Okay. And his infinite knowledge, his omniscience, how did that impact their relationship with him?
Well, it fostered a sense of intimate knowledge and, again, profound awe. Psalm 139 also delves into this, emphasizing that God knows them intimately, every thought, every intention.
That's really personal.
It is. And Psalm 147 reminds them that his understanding is beyond human comprehension. It speaks to a God who truly sees and knows them.
Wow. Okay, what about eternity? How would his timeless existence be a comfort?
It makes him their ultimate refuge, a constant and timeless anchor in a world that is constantly changing.
Like a rock in a storm.
Yes, exactly. As Psalm 90 so eloquently expresses, he was and is and always will be their God.
Always constant. Okay. And immutability, the fact that he doesn't change, that must have been a source of stability.
Absolutely. It ensures their preservation.
It does.
As Malachi 3:6 states, "For I, the Lord, do not change. Therefore you, O sons of Jacob, are not destroyed."
That's a powerful promise.
His unchanging nature is a bedrock of reliability and the foundation for his consistent promises.
So they can trust him.
They always can.
Finally, his matchless greatness. How did that impact their worship?
That simply compels worship. Exodus 15 and Psalm 86 are filled with praise for his incomparable greatness and power.
I can imagine.
Recognizing his surpassing excellence naturally leads to adoration and reverence.
It's like being in the presence of something truly magnificent. It's awe-inspiring.
That's a great way to put it.
Okay, so it's really striking how these attributes, which can seem so abstract, directly shaped how God's people understood his care and interacted with him.
Yeah, it brings it down to earth.
Now, let's move on to the communicable attributes, the aspects of his character that he shares with humanity.
Yes. And Peterson acknowledges that this distinction can have nuances.
Sure.
But it provides a helpful framework for understanding God.
Okay, I like frameworks. So which attributes are we talking about here?
These attributes include personality, sovereignty, wisdom, truthfulness, faithfulness, holiness, righteousness, love, grace, mercy, goodness, patience, and glory.
Okay, that's another substantial list.
It is, but they're all so important.
I know, right? And as Peterson knows, while we humans share these, there's still a huge difference between God's perfect expression and our limited, you know, human reflections.
Precisely. Our wisdom is finite.
Right.
Our holiness is flawed. Our love is often self-centered. Yet because we are created in his image, we do reflect these attributes to some degree. And Peterson provides specific examples of how these communicable attributes influenced the beliefs and lives of the Israelites.
So how did these attributes play out in real life for them?
Well, let's look at some examples.
Let's.
How about God's personality? How did that impact their understanding and relationship with him?
Okay. Yeah, that's a good one to start with.
Well, it allowed them to know him intimately as a personal God.
Right.
Unlike the often distant or impersonal deities of surrounding culture.
Oh, yeah. The other gods were much less personal.
Right. And David's heartfelt expressions of love and his seeking of God's faithful love in Psalms 18 and 36, they really illustrate this personal connection. It's a you and me relationship.
It is.
It's very special.
Okay. What about his sovereignty? How did they understand his control over events?
They recognized his ultimate authority and control, even in the midst of human choices and actions. You know, Joseph's understanding of his brother's betrayal in Genesis 45 and 50, that even their evil intentions were ultimately woven into God's good plan, is a powerful example of how they saw God's hand at work.
That's such an amazing story.
It really is.
Okay, and his wisdom. How do they look to God for wisdom?
They acknowledge him as the very source of all true wisdom, especially for their leaders.
It makes sense that they would go to the source.
Right. Joshua being filled with wisdom in Deuteronomy 34, Daniel giving God praise for wisdom in Daniel 2, and the book of Proverbs stating that the Lord gives wisdom, it all underscores this reliance on God as the ultimate source of understanding.
So they really saw him as the source of wisdom.
Yeah.
Okay, truthfulness. It seems like such a foundational attribute for trust. How did that manifest in their faith?
They placed absolute trust in God's word as completely true.
As they should.
As they should. And it's emphasized in Psalms 31 and 119.
Good stuff.
This led them to choose the way of truth, you know? And Abraham's belief in God's promise being credited to him as righteousness in Genesis 15, this is a cornerstone of their faith. And it highlights the crucial role of trusting God's truth.
Right. And that idea is elaborated on later in the New Testament, too.
It is.
Okay, what about faithfulness? How do they experience God's faithfulness?
Even during times of immense hardship, like the destruction of Jerusalem, which is so powerfully lamented in Lamentations, faithful Israelites remembered and proclaimed God's steadfast love and faithfulness.
It must have been hard to hold on to during those times.
It was. But they knew God wouldn't abandon them.
So they clung to it as their enduring hope.
Yes. It was a recognition that even when things looked bleak, God's character remained constant.
Wow, that's deep. Okay, holiness, that must have been a profound and perhaps even intimidating concept.
Oh, definitely. Isaiah's overwhelming encounter with God's holiness in Isaiah 6, his immediate sense of his own impurity and then God's gracious cleansing that provides a powerful glimpse into their understanding of God's absolute purity.
It's almost scary.
Yeah, a little bit. It shows their deep need for forgiveness and cleansing in his presence.
So they recognize their own sinfulness in contrast to his holiness.
Exactly.
Okay. And righteousness. What did that imply about God's actions?
They understood that God loves righteous deeds and will judge with justice.
Right. He's a just God.
As Psalms 11 and 96 declare, it also meant that he cared for the vulnerable and expected his people to do the same.
Oh, that's nice.
Isn't it? And we see that in Deuteronomy 15 in the context of caring for those in need.
Okay, so he calls them to act justly as well.
Exactly.
Now we come to some of the attributes that we often connect most strongly with God. Love, grace, mercy, patience.
Oh, yeah. These are the big ones, right?
They are.
And they're so powerfully demonstrated throughout the Old Testament. Peterson directs us to God's interactions with David after his sin in 2 Samuel 12.
Okay.
Where, despite facing judgment, David also experiences God's enduring love, resulting in the birth of Solomon, who was loved by the Lord.
Oh, yeah. It all comes full circle. And the story of Hosea and Gomer, that's an incredibly vivid illustration of God's persistent love and grace toward an unfaithful people.
It's a powerful picture.
It is. Even the story of Ruth demonstrates God's mercy extending beyond the boundaries of Israel.
Right. It shows that God's love isn't limited.
Okay. So those are some great examples of his love, grace, and mercy.
Yeah. I love those stories.
What about goodness? How did they see God's goodness in action?
David's kindness to Mephibosheth in 2 Samuel 9, reflecting the covenant he had made with Jonathan, is a beautiful example of God's goodness being mirrored in human action.
Right. It's like God's goodness flowing through David.
Exactly.
Okay. Patience. That's something we humans often struggle with.
Tell me about it.
How is it shown in the Old Testament?
Well, the account of Noah and the 120-year delay before the flood, as recounted in Genesis and later referenced in the New Testament, that really underscores God's remarkable patience, you know, giving humanity ample time to turn from their ways.
Right. He's long-suffering.
He is. He really is.
And finally, glory. How did they perceive God's glory?
They understood God's glory as his inherent radiant majesty. Moses' awe-filled encounters with God in Exodus 33 and 34, and the glory that filled the tabernacle in Exodus 40, those were foundational experiences.
They sound amazing.
They do, don't they? Peterson also points to the amazing truth that God shares his glory with those who believe.
Oh, wow.
And that concept is further developed in the New Testament.
It's amazing how all of this connects. It's so clear that the Old Testament people of God had a rich and multifaceted understanding of their God,
definitely,
both through his unique and his shared attributes. Now, let's turn our attention to the other crucial aspect Peterson addresses, atonement.
Yes. And Peterson emphasizes that God's provision of atonement was another defining characteristic that uniquely set his Old Testament people apart.
So in what way? What distinguished their understanding and practice from those of other ancient Near Eastern societies?
Unlike their surrounding neighbors, they had a sacrificial system that was specifically ordained by God as the means for the forgiveness of sins.
Okay.
This wasn't a human invention or a way to appease angry gods. It was a divinely given system for reconciliation.
So is God initiated?
It is. God taking the first step.
And the book of Leviticus is central to understanding this system of atonement, isn't it?
Absolutely. Leviticus focuses extensively on these God-ordained sacrifices, culminating in the solemn observances of the Day of Atonement. And Peterson also reminds us of Isaiah's later prophetic glimpses of a sinless servant whose sacrifice would have profound significance.
We'll have to come back to Isaiah another time.
Yeah, that deserves its own deep dive.
But for now, let's stick with Leviticus. Peterson breaks down the five main types of offerings described in Leviticus. He draws on the analysis of J. Sklar for this. Can you give us a concise overview of each and its primary purpose?
Certainly. The burnt offering, detailed in Leviticus 1, served for atonement and also as a way to express prayers of petition or praise, a complete offering to God. The grain offering, in chapter 2, often accompanied other offerings and symbolized dedication and thanksgiving.
It's interesting how these physical offerings have these deeper spiritual meanings.
Right. It wasn't just about the physical act. Then we have the fellowship offering in chapter 3. This emphasized the restored covenant relationship with the Lord and with fellow Israelites.
Ah, so there's a community aspect here.
There is. It often involved a shared meal.
I like that.
Then there's the purification offering, found in chapters 4 and 5, which provided atonement for specific unintentional sins.
Okay, so it's specific to certain types of sin.
Right. And it carried the metaphorical sense of cleansing.
It's like a ritual washing.
It is, in a way. And finally, there's the reparation offering, also in chapters 5 and 6, which was for atonement for specific sins that involved some form of wrong against another person or against God's holy things.
So this is about making things right.
Exactly. It often required restitution.
So while each offering had its specific nuances, the overarching theme is God's provision of a way to deal with sin and restore relationship.
That's the core of it.
Right. It's not about following rules for the sake of rules. It's about relationship.
Exactly. And Peterson highlights Sklar's important point that this entire sacrificial system was a gracious gift from God.
Oh, that's great.
It's a means of atonement and forgiveness that he himself provided. It wasn't about them earning God's favor through their sacrifices.
That's a critical distinction to grasp. It really underscores God's initiative in the process of reconciliation.
It does.
And the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, stood as the most significant day within this system, didn't it?
It did indeed. Peterson, referencing Sklar again, emphasizes that the Day of Atonement powerfully demonstrates God's grace and forgiveness. Leviticus 16 provides a detailed account of the elaborate ceremonies performed on that day.
It sounds pretty intense.
It was.
Can you walk us through the key sacrifices that the high priest offered on that solemn occasion?
Sure. There were three primary sacrifices. First, a sin offering of a bull was offered for Aaron himself and his family.
Yeah.
This was to purify them before he could minister on behalf of the entire nation. Second, there was a sin offering involving two male goats.
Two goats?
Yeah, two. One goat was sacrificed for the sins of the people, and its blood was brought into the most holy place and sprinkled on the mercy seat. The other goat, known as the scapegoat, had the sins of the entire nation symbolically placed upon its head by the high priest, and then it was led away and released into the wilderness.
That imagery is so powerful.
Isn't it? Ellen Ross's analysis, which Peterson mentions, highlights the substitutionary nature of this act. The sins were transferred and carried away.
It's like the goat is taking their sins away with it.
Exactly.
And what was the third main sacrifice?
The third was a burnt offering of two rams.
Okay.
One for the high priest and one for the people. This signified their complete consecration and dedication to God.
It's like a renewal of their commitment.
Yeah, like starting fresh.
Peterson also mentions the significance of the cloud of incense that covered the mercy seat. What was the purpose of that?
Yes, drawing on Hertz, Peterson explains that the purpose of the incense smoke was to create a protective screen. It prevented the high priest from directly looking upon God's holy presence.
Why was that necessary?
Because God's presence was so powerful that it would result in death for sinful humanity.
Oh, wow.
It underscores the immense seriousness of approaching a holy God with sin present.
Okay, so it was a matter of protection.
It was.
And why were these elaborate atonement rituals even necessary in the first place? What problem were they addressing?
Well, as Peterson explains, based on Sklar's work, Israel's sin was seen as defiling God's dwelling place. You know, the tabernacle, specifically the Holy of Holies. The atonement rituals, especially those performed on the Day of Atonement, were God's gracious way of cleansing these defilements so that the covenant relationship and fellowship could continue.
So it's about maintaining that connection with God.
It is. It's about purity and holiness.
So if we bring it all together, how did the Day of Atonement specifically define God's Old Testament people?
Sklar's perspective, which Peterson highlights, is that the Day of Atonement defined them as the people for whom God himself provided a way for atonement.
That's beautiful.
It is, isn't it? It defined them as the people whose sins he graciously forgave and cleansed. It was entirely God's initiative to deal with their sin and impurity, allowing them to remain in a covenant relationship with him.
It all goes back to that covenant relationship.
It really does. And Psalm 103, which Peterson references, beautifully captures this compassionate and forgiving nature of God.
It's such a moving psalm. It's a powerful reminder that at the very heart of the Old Testament, there's this profound element of God's grace reaching out to his people.
Absolutely.
Peterson notes that the next logical step in this understanding would be to explore Isaiah 53 and the sacrifice of the suffering servant.
Oh, yeah. That's a dub topic.
It is. But that's a deep dive for another time, perhaps.
Definitely.
But for now, we have gained a much clearer understanding of how God's people in the Old Testament were uniquely defined by their covenant relationship with the God who revealed his character in such profound ways.
And who, out of his own graciousness, provided a means for their atonement.
That's precisely it. And it really prompts you, dear listener, to consider how understanding God's character and his provision for atonement in the Old Testament informs and shapes your understanding of his relationship with humanity today.
Yes, it makes you think.
It does. What aspects of God's nature and actions that we've explored resonate most deeply with you? And how might reflecting on these ancient truths enrich your own understanding of God and your relationship with him?
So much to ponder.
It's certainly a topic that invites ongoing reflection and deeper exploration. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.
It's been a pleasure.